Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Tim Padgett is out this week. Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, has existed since 1990. It's a special protection granted by the Department of Homeland Security that protects foreign-born people who are unable to return home safely because of natural disasters, war and violence, or other extraordinary conditions. Haitians were first granted that status in 2010 after a massive earthquake struck the country, and it has been extended continuously since then. The Biden administration extended it most recently through February of this year. The Trump administration last year tried to end TPS, but it was halted by the courts. That is, until this week, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling in Mullen v. Doe that effectively ended protected status for Haitians and Syrians living in the United States. That means nearly 350,000 Haitians are now illegal residents of the U.S. In South Florida, home to the largest Haitian community in the country, the effects are likely to be devastating to local communities. Are you or someone you know affected by the ending of TPS for Haitians? Or are you someone currently protected by TPS and worried about that status changing? Call us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss the fallout of the Supreme Court decision is Franly Julien, a Haitian-born immigration lawyer who practices in North Miami Beach. Franly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Carlton.
Some Haitians have been in the United States since TPS was first offered in 2010. Some have children who are American citizens, but TPS never offered a path to citizenship for Haitians who are protected by it. Can you just lay out for our listeners what's being lost here when TPS goes away? What does TPS do when, you know, like not offering a pathway to citizenship, what does it not do?
So when TPS was created, enacted in 1990, it was a way for the U.S. government to act on the ideals the United States has always professed to protect, you know, to be this beacon on the hill, to provide shelter to those in need, particularly neighbors like Haiti, Venezuela, and other countries. Now, what TPS does, it allows nationals of designated countries not only to remain in the United States legally, but to also work legally. So they have a work permit that allows them to seek employment and maintain employment, if you know. Now, on top of that, TPS also allows people to maintain status for adjustment purposes. Let's say someone comes to the United States and is granted a 6-month authorized stay, and we have cases like this, and this person, before the authorized stay expires, they are granted TPS.
Right.
They maintain lawful status. If the opportunity presents itself, they can adjust status, whereas others, because they did not have TPS, they cannot adjust status because they have lost non-immigrant status, valid non-immigrant status. It's a little technical, but TPS does more than allowing people to stay here legally and to work in the United States.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Supreme Court case that's at issue here. Can you give us an overline and a timeline on Mullen v. Doe and the consolidated cases the court ruled on?
So initially, we had two cases, the case for Syria and the case for Haiti. At some point, the administration went to the Supreme Court and requested certiorari. Basically, it's asking the Supreme Court to accept the case and issue a ruling on the expedited docket, the shadow docket. The legal teams defending Haiti and Syria, they not only responded to the administration's request, but they also lodged their own demand to the Supreme Court, asking that the cases not be heard on the shadow docket, that they be afforded the opportunity to present oral argument, which was done on the 29th of April. And I was fortunate enough to be in the room when the Supreme Court was hearing the arguments. But even then, that day, the nonchalance with which some of the judges, when the government, the Solicitor General, was making the government's case, they were attentive to the argument. But once the other, the TPS legal team, the plaintiffs were making their cases, they were sleeping. They were like, they closed their eyes. They're not paying attention.
The justices of the Supreme Court were closing their eyes during
Someone like Justice Alito, for instance, he was conveying the message that, oh, I'm not paying attention to what you're saying, you know. So we had a sense back then that it was clear that the arguments did not matter to them. Their minds were already set.
I was going to ask you if you were shocked by this ruling. And the reaction this week was broad, I think, across media channels. But this court has already allowed the Trump administration to strip TPS from Venezuelans. So, and I guess from your presence in the room, you're not surprised.
I'm not surprised at all. And on top of that, I was sitting with a local, you know, immigration attorney from Florida who has more than 40 years of experience. And I told him, I say, am I authorized to be optimistic? And he said, no, we have a bad court. It's a bad court. You cannot be optimistic as to the ruling to come. Yeah.
So how soon does this take effect for people who have TPS? What does this ruling mean as far as a timeline for them?
So here's the thing. There were three claims lodged before the court by the legal teams. The first one was the EPA claim, the Administrative Procedure Act claim. Congress is the province of Congress to legislate, right? Now, through the Administrative Procedure Act, Congress delegates its ability to legislate to the executive branch, and this is how the executive branch can designate a country for, can grant TPS.
Right, and this is also how things like the EPA can issue like environmental protections.
Absolutely. So the team defending, the legal team defending TPS, they said the Administrative Procedure Act was violated by the government. So that was claim number one. Claim number two is a violation of the TPS statute itself. So the TPS statute requests that the government consult with other agencies of the government, that DHS consult with them. And not only during oral arguments, it was clear that the consultation did not happen, but later on during the Venezuela litigation, they were able to get more documents. And after oral argument on the 29th of April, they went back to the Supreme Court asking them to dismiss the government's request for certiorari based on the new information. And the Supreme Court totally ignored that, this motion to dismiss. So this was claim number two, the violation of the TPS statute. And claim number three is the violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court's decision basically states that the court's the decision to end TPS is not reviewable by the courts based on violation of the APA, right. Administrative Procedure Act. Mm-hmm. Claim number two was denied as well by the Supreme Court, that violation of the statute by the government is not reviewable. Now, what the Supreme Court did, it remanded the case to the lower court as to the Equal Protection Clause, but the Supreme Court made the argument for the court. It says it's really unlikely that plaintiffs can prevail on the Equal Protection Clause. They foreclose any possibility for the lower court to issue a favorable ruling.
They put their thumb on the scale for that component by telling you the burden of proof is going to be much too high for plaintiffs to ever reach.
Absolutely. That's what they did.
Well, and I want to talk about that second point you made about the agencies that communicated with each other, because there is a disconnect with how the State Department and Homeland Security view the status in Haiti. To remove TPS is a claim that it's safe to send people back to that country, right? But the State Department has a do not travel restriction on Haiti. It's the highest possible rating they can give because of the gang violence that's killed thousands and displaced, you know, more than a million at this point. The Justice Alito's majority decision even claims or cites coordination between DHS and the State Department of this decision. But during the course of this trial, immigration lawyers found out, like you said, that coordination never happened. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Not only that the coordination did not happen. Later on, through discovery, while the legal teams were working on the Venezuela case, they get their hands on internal memos and emails from the administrations. And some of those documents, one of them, for instance, shows that initially the functionaries within DHS had decided that based on the situation in Haiti, it needs to be an automatic renewal, renewal of TPS, redesignation of TPS, right? So this is document number one.
Which we should say, TPS does need to be renewed every 18 months.
Yes. Now, Kristi Noem, well, she was there. She asked functionaries of DHS to identify Haitian nationals living in the United States who are involved in gangs and terrorist activities. One functionary conducted the search and could not find any. Now, there's a gentleman by the name of Joseph Edlow. Joseph Edlow went back and stated, you have to change that because if there's no terrorist hit, we cannot end TPS. So he asked the functionary to change that, the reality that there are no Haitians involved in terrorist activities. A few days later, Joseph Edlow became the head of USCIS.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So all of this information was given subsequently to the debate, to the Supreme Court, as part of the motion to dismiss. They totally ignored it.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. We're speaking with Franly Julien, a Haitian-born immigration lawyer, about the Supreme Court's decision that allows TPS for Haiti to end. A reminder that you can join our conversation when you call 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. I also want to talk about that point of the gang violence in Haiti, and they didn't find evidence of it, but there is certainly plenty of gang violence in the country of Haiti right now. In the legal filings for this case, immigration lawyers said that four women who were deported back to Haiti in February were found decapitated
Yes.
and thrown into the river.
Yes.
Obviously, there is ongoing gang violence in the country. What are the conditions in Haiti right now that people could be sent back to?
So I need to clarify that they did not find evidence of Haitians involved in terrorist activities in the United States.
Right.
Okay, that was the goal, to justify their decision.
Which could, by proving that, they could end TPS by saying we are allowing, you know, essentially terrorists into the country.
National security grounds, right?
Right.
Absolutely. Now, also, one thing I wanted to mention is that when Kristi Noem decided that she's going to, because usually when they're ending TPS, the reason is the conditions on the ground have improved.
Mm-hmm.
But for Haiti, the reason was that national security interest of the United States warrants an end to TPS for Haitians. And the legal team found a document from one of the functionaries stating, this is a first. We've never done that before. Mm-hmm. You know, all of this was submitted to the Supreme Court. Now, to your question, Haiti's situation is worse today than it has been at any designation or redesignation time. There's no way anyone can justify that Haiti not be redesignated for TPS, or that the latest designation be reconducted. There's no justification for that. The situation in Haiti today, basically the gangs are in control everywhere in Haiti. You have a few oases areas where, mm-hmm. It's more or less safe, but the gangs, the police are outgunned by the gangs. So the gangs are effectively in control. Government officials, to commemorate national holidays, they have to negotiate with the gangs,
right,
so that they can have access to monuments, to commemorate national holidays. Haiti is really, really in shambles today, and this decision is going to worsen the situation.
One of the other arguments that was made in this case is that the administration's decision to end TPS was not based on policy, but on racial animus. In the majority opinion issued by the Supreme Court, Alito says that the comments made by the president could reasonably be seen as, quote, policy views that could rest on race-neutral justifications. Alito doesn't specifically cite instances of these, quote, race-neutral justifications, but the dissenting opinion does. They include Trump's claim during the 2024 elections that Haitians are eating cats and dogs in Ohio, that Haitian immigration is, quote, like a death wish to our country, and Trump calling Haiti a S-hole country and lamenting that the United States is taking Haitian immigrants and not people from Norway and Sweden. What is your response to Alito's claim about these instances?
There's also another statement by President Trump that Haitians are poisoning the blood of the country,
mm-hmm.
And this is straight out of the Nazi playbook. My reaction to that is that the Supreme Court, because they are so in lockstep with the government, perhaps without realizing it, they are raising the threshold for what is racist or what is racist and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
If you tell me that President Trump's statements and actions, for instance, President Trump has effectively ended asylum, the right to asylum in the United States, and at the same time is allowing white South Africans to come to the United States as refugees, which is totally ridiculous. So what the court is doing, the court is enabling the president to do what he's doing, which is overtly racist, but the court is also raising the threshold as to what is racist and what is not in the United States.
What's the response been for your office? Are you being flooded with calls right now? And what are immigration lawyers like you and yourself telling people?
It's crazy, man. People are calling at 1 a.m., 2 a.m. And there's a portrayal of Haitian that does not, by American, right-wing media and operators, that does not fit reality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a few people, for instance. I have a girl whose father called me this morning. She's on TPS while completing law school. She's in law school. I have one client of mine who currently has a removal order. He is currently completing his PhD, and he's been a school teacher for the last 15 years. I have a client who came to the United States. She was 4. Not only did she complete her master's degree in engineering, she's also covering tuition and cost for her sister,
mm-hmm.
who was born in the United States, was completing her PhD. This is the kind of people that will be deported, removed from the United States because of this decision. But there's another aspect to it. I think people are overlooking the injustice. If we want to assess the entire injustice that this decision will bring about, this decision dovetails with a previous 1960 decision by the Supreme Court, which stands for the proposition that if you are deported from the United States, you lose your Social Security benefits.
Right.
So when Haiti was designated in 2010, in the body of the Federal Register notice, it is stated that between 100 and 200,000 people qualified. That was back in 2010. Today, at least 120,000 people of these people qualify for Social Security benefits. Mm-hmm. Some of them have started, due to their age, have started to receive those benefits. These benefits are ending. So This is not a gift. This is not government handout.
Right.
Those people have earned it.
Yep.
Not only are they losing their benefits, they will be deported from the United States to a country they haven't been in 15 or so years, you know, without those benefits after contributing their best years to America's economy.
And quickly here, I want to focus on, obviously, you've explained what it looks like for individuals who are affected by this. But in just a minute or so here, can you paint a picture of what it looks like for the broader South Florida community? We have the largest Haitian community here in South Florida. There's as many as 150,000 Haitian TPS holders here. They're part of the economy. They're part of schools. They're part of social circles. How badly will this area feel the impact, and what might it look like?
It's unfortunate that the business sector was not as vocal that it should have been, but everybody's afraid of the government, of the president. If you take sectors like elder care, health care, hospitality and tourism, construction, agriculture, the Haitian presence is heavy. It's a heavy presence. So all those sectors will be affected by this decision.
Franley Julien is a Haitian-born immigration lawyer who practices in North Miami Beach. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
When we come back, we dive into our reporter's notebooks on the 5-year anniversary of the Surfside tragedy. And before we take a break, a reminder that you can enjoy the best of this week's WLRN feature stories and their impactful reporting on South Florida with our weekend newsletter. Sign up at WLRNnews.org/newsletters. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. This past Wednesday, June 24th, marked the 5th anniversary of the tragedy that came to be known simply as Surfside. The building fell in the middle of the night in 2021. The partial collapse of the Champlain Tower South condo claimed 98 lives in one of the deadliest building failures in U.S. history. In the course of WLRN's reporting on the tragedy and its aftermath, there are moments we'll never forget. Morning news anchor Christine DiMattei still carries one particular memory with her on her cell phone.
It's not very often that I get a direct call from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., but this was the voicemail message I received in the early morning hours of June 24th, 2021.
Going down the phone list here, trying to find someone at your station. There has been a mass casualty event in Miami Beach on Collins Avenue, where a 10-story apartment block had collapsed.
I called him back immediately and told him I would find out what I could. My next call was to our news partners at the Miami Herald. The morning editor there told me what he knew so far. My third call was to the news director here at WLRN, and after stammering out what little info I had, I ended the call with three words. This is bad. WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero was one of the first journalists on the scene that morning. Danny, can you tell us what first went through your mind when you arrived there?
When I first pulled up in the vicinity, I got as far as a block or two south of where the collapse had happened. There was police tape roped off. We could not see what was going on. It was still nighttime. I got there around 4:30 in the morning. And then my colleague, Veronica Saragovia, arrived at some point, and then she showed up, and we were both kind of wondering what to do. We still didn't have a visual of what was going on. And it went through my mind that I had gone to many drum circles that they hold on Miami Beach on the full moon, and I knew the area very well. I knew there was actually a hole in the fence at the park just south of where we were. So I said, Veronica, let's go through the hole in the fence and then go through the park so we could get to the beach side. So we did that. We got to the beach, and then the police had taped off the beach area so you couldn't cross. And at some point I said, no, we're going to run through that police tape. So we actually ran through the sand. We got yelled at by a police officer, but we still made it to the other side. And then just as the morning sun was rising over the beach, we saw a visual image of what happened. And I said, oh my God. And Chris, then I sent you a windy voicemail moments after that telling you exactly what I saw so we could get it onto the radio as soon as possible.
And here's a bit of that tape.
You know, the only way to describe it currently is that it looks like the Oklahoma City bombing, something of that sort.
And as the day got started, the sun came up, we started to talk to people on the boardwalk, and I actually broke the news to people in person, to many of them who were just out walking their dogs. They didn't understand what the commotion was. And people who lived in the building and nearby were also out there just looking at the building in the morning sun and talking among themselves, crying. I talked to one woman, Anne Citron. She was visiting from Tampa, and she was staying next door, and she heard a deep rumble at some point. She said it sounded like a military plane flying very close to the ground.
And then we go to the staircase, and there's all this dust in the staircase. And you go outside, and fire trucks pulling up, and there's people outside, and people saying they were tracked. There was people on their balconies with flashlights, with their phones, just waiting to be rescued.
My goodness. Danny, do we know at that point how many people were trapped and calling out for help?
We do know that 35 people were successfully rescued from the partially collapsed building during those first few hours. And later on, my colleague Veronica Saragovio got the 911 calls from that morning from people who lived nearby.
There's a lot of smoke going on. I can't see anything right now.
You see smoke? Like something underground, everything exploded down at 8777 Collins, okay, Avenue.
We have a call already. We have help on the way out there.
And for the first few days, it was a full search and rescue mission.
Right. This was a round-the-clock thing. There were international eyes on this incident. And a few days after the initial collapse, officials imploded the rest of the remaining building because the remains of the structure were actually making the search and rescue operations more difficult because it was so unstable, they had to keep pausing. And so 2 weeks after the collapse on July 7th, the effort was then changed officially from a search and rescue mission to a search and recovery mission. And it was presumed at that point that anyone who remained there that was not found would be among victims and they would be dead.
And the victims ranged in age from a one-year-old infant to a 92-year-old grandmother.
That's right. And there were 98 total victims representing 14 different nationalities from the U.S. and Cuba to Paraguay, Italy, Australia, really tremendously diverse community.
Now, a federal investigation into the collapse began the very next day. The first reports that came out of that seemed to focus on the building's pool deck. Danny, 5 years later, what do we know about what might have caused this disaster?
Right. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology did immediately start an investigation. We're still waiting on the final report. But the initial preliminary reports that have been released already have identified the pool deck area as the source of the physical collapse. Now, they have also identified lapses in maintenance done by the condo board. And it was immediately after the collapse and this tragedy happening that there was really widespread focus on how condo boards are governed and how they handle repairs that are needed and people know that they're needed, but just do not happen.
As is usually the case after a tragedy like this, there is a fierce determination to make sure that it just never happens again. And that led to a fair degree of panic about the state of older buildings here in South Florida. So, Danny, the next step was Florida lawmakers determined to make some changes.
Right. You know, in the wake of this, there were across-the-board calls for major reform on condominium law. This was Democrats, Republicans, Independents. People desperately wanted and needed answers, and they needed to prevent a tragedy like this from ever happening again. So I talked to Jason Pizzo, at the time a Democratic state senator, whose district included Surfside. This was a tragedy that happened in his district. And he told me major reforms were needed.
It's basically something where Florida has just for so long bent over backwards to incentivize development and basically to be completely subservient to, you know, sort of go it alone and property rights as opposed to, I'm not a huge fan of overregulation, but we're talking about life safety issues.
And other Florida lawmakers were thinking very much the same. In the aftermath of the Champlain Tower South collapse, the state legislature took on a very difficult challenge in public policy, and that was overhauling rules governing the safety of aging residential buildings. That's led to a dramatic change in condo law, which in turn has led to a drastically reshaped real estate market here in Florida. And here to talk about both is WLRN's Tom Hudson.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Now, what was the first legislative response to the collapse?
Relatively quickly after the collapse, the first legislative response that we had out of the State House was passed unanimously. Everybody agreed to this first piece of legislation. It was during a special session in 2022, of which there were many special sessions. Among the things it did was have inspection procedures and deadlines for the entire state. Miami-Dade and Broward have had some special inspection and deadlines over the course of many decades, but to expand that across the state, most buildings three stories and higher had to be inspected after 30 years and then 10 years after. And if you're closer to the coastline, it was after 25 years of construction and then every 10 years. And then there were reserve requirements, which is a fancy way of saying the savings accounts for these condominium associations. And they initially had to have money in the bank by New Year's Eve of 2024 to pay for the necessary repairs that were found during these structural inspections.
Everything you just mentioned, how did that change the way that HOAs and condo boards function?
Well, it was a significant change for 65 counties, right? Not necessarily Broward or Miami-Dade County, which have had these inspection rules in place for a good number of decades, but then expanding that across the state. So it was a real shock to the system in terms of the necessary structural inspections that needed to be done on older condominium buildings, and then the financial requirements statewide across all 67 counties. Those were new, Chris, and that really was tectonic shifts in how condominium owners and condominium associations approached reserve savings accounts, of how much money they could and needed to stick aside for necessary maintenance. You know, for a long time, Chris, a Florida condo was thought to be relatively low-cost living. And one of the reasons was because condominium associations kept those monthly fees artificially low.
A lot of Florida lawmakers were on board with reform. They said, you know, it's high time, it's past time that we do this. And one of the many people that you've spoken to was former Florida State Representative Republican Vicky Lopez of Miami-Dade. She is now a county commissioner, but she was one of the lawmakers who led the charge for condo reform. Here's what she told you during an interview in June 2024. This was 3 years after Surfside.
I'm telling people not to buy a condominium now. Wait for things to settle down. Wait for the assessments to be, you know, clarified. Wait till you have more information. And I believe that by 2026, everyone will know what they're buying. I'm a person who likes to see a lot of transparency and clarity, especially in business transactions. And that's why I'm recommending wait till we know what the assessments really are.
You know, Tom, there is so much when you choose condo living. You pay a lot for that hassle-free life, you know, to have the people clean the pools and repair the roof, keep the landscaping nice, and assessments are part of that. Now, to that point, you spoke with Tim Johnson. He owns a condo on Miami Beach. He told you about a special assessment he had to start paying about a year after the first round of condo reforms.
And that is a really big one. It's a $10 million special assessment to be paid off over 15 years. And if you're financing it like most people do for an apartment like I have, it's $315 a month for 15 years.
Ouch.
Substantial increase in your living costs that you may not have budgeted for at the beginning of the year. And here it is, this special assessment that's been foisted upon you, which is part of that risk of being a condominium owner. And it gets to, I think, one of the real unintended consequences of the initial reforms after Surfside, the reforms to the reforms, and then the reforms to the reforms to the reform. There's been several legislative processes in here to try to lessen the financial blow, especially for condominium owners like Tim in Miami Beach, that they have the ability to come up with the money or at least finance over the course of a number of years.
And along with that, shifting views, among them, lawmakers. Mm-hmm. Tom, you did a follow-up with Vicky Lopez a year after that initial talk. Remember when she said, no, don't buy.
Yeah.
Okay, so in May of last year, You did a follow-up, and here's what she told you.
So I feel much better. I feel now that the structural integrity reserve studies have been done. Milestone inspections are being done. We finally have the information that I think anybody, a prospective buyer of a condo unit, needs to have.
You know, Chris, we did see the supply of condominiums on the market shoot up as folks that were facing big special assessments or much higher monthly assessments simply couldn't afford them any longer. So they went on the market. You also had buyers retreat from the market, which also increased supply because buyers were very uncertain about what they would be getting into with a condominium relationship, not the square footage, but the financial relationship with the condominium associations.
So, Tom, in brief, what is the enduring effect of Surfside, of that tragedy, on the market now?
Hopefully the enduring result is no more Surfsides, that Florida condominium buildings are in good shape or are being repaired for those that need to be repaired for structural integrity, and then have the financial wherewithal to have regular maintenance so as not to put the owners in financial straits. I think we have seen the condominium market in the past year respond pretty positively. A year ago, we saw the pace of condominium sales statewide continuing to decline. We saw the median price of condominiums sold a year ago continue to decline. This April, compared to a year ago, the pace of sales has increased by about 7%, and there's been no change in the median price, which is better than a decrease. No change is better than a decrease. Not an increase yet, but it's at least no change. So it seems to be stabilizing here as we acknowledge this anniversary of the Surfside collapse.
And Danny, back to you. For the last 5 years, the loved ones of the 98 people killed in the Surfside disaster have been working very hard for a permanent memorial in their honor. How is that going?
There is not yet a permanent memorial. There's been many temporary memorials set up around the perimeter. Now, the site of the collapse has been sold and new condos have been developed there, and they do exist. They haven't sold any as of April, according to The Real Deal. But the town of Surfside does say there are plans underway to create a permanent memorial for the 98 victims within the years to come.
Now, Danny, as I said at the start, you were one of the first reporters on the scene that morning. For the rest of your career, or for the rest of your life, when someone says the word Surfside, evoking this tragedy, What is going to be the first thing that you think of?
The most important part of it is, I think, of the lasting impact on the people. I mean, this community at the Champlain Tower South building was a very close-knit community, and they experienced this as a community. And the impact it left on Surfside as a town, Miami Beach, the greater Miami area and the whole state of Florida is something we're always going to remember. I'll certainly remember it.
You've just heard.
I as well.
You've just heard WLRN's Christine DiMatte, Tom Hudson, and Danny Rivero with a reporter's retrospective on the Surfside tragedy. In a new technical report that was released at the beginning of the week, federal investigators say the deadly collapse of the Champlain Tower South condominium in Surfside started weeks before the building came down. The latest National Institute of Standards and Technology report found that the two connections between the garage columns and the pool deck started to fail in early June. The 40-year-old structure's design and later alterations meant that other parts of the pool deck weren't strong enough to take the extra load. Still to come, what's the state of Venezuela following two massive earthquakes? That and more after the break. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie, filling in for Tim Padgett. Wednesday evening, Venezuela was hit with a major 7.2 magnitude earthquake. 39 seconds later, Venezuela shook again. This time, a magnitude 7.5 quake, nearly three times as powerful, rocked one of the country's most populated areas. These are the strongest earthquakes to hit Venezuela in almost a century. There is destruction from the epicenter 30 miles west to the capital city of Caracas. In the seaside city of La Guayra, hundreds of buildings have toppled. Acting President Delcy Rodriguez said on state television last night that 589 people have died and nearly 3,000 have been injured. Those numbers are expected to climb as people remain trapped under rubble. Many thousands are still missing. Here in South Florida, communities are reeling. Family members here are waiting to hear about their loved ones back home, and aid is being mobilized. Have you or your community been impacted by the earthquakes in Venezuela? Call us, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Joining me now to talk about what's happening on the ground, both here and in Venezuela, is the executive director of the South Florida-based Venezuelan American Caucus, Adelis Ferrero. Adelis, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for supporting our community in the middle of all of this tragedy.
I understand that you have family in Venezuela. Have you heard about their condition and their safety?
Yes, my mom lives in Caracas. My sister also lives in Caracas. They don't live together. For family reasons, my mom was staying with her, with my sister, and my sister lives in a in the 13th floor of a building in a hill in the southeast of Caracas. And honestly, I found out about the earthquake almost immediately because of social media. Mm-hmm. And I started trying to call her, first my mom, then my sister. Long story short, it took me almost 3 hours without not knowing about them, imagining everything and anything. But thank God they are okay. My sister just had a small cut on her forehead because some things were falling off. They tried to get to the bathroom. I don't even know why, but we are very, very lucky. We are one of the fortunate ones, but many, many, many other Venezuelan families are not.
And you've touched on there have been significant challenges for some here in South Florida contacting loved ones. People have waited hours, and the hours have turned into days now to make sure that everyone they know is okay or accounted for. Why has it been so difficult to reestablish contact for these people?
Well, at the beginning, obviously, the cell phone communications were really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. The landlines communications were completely dead. Many are completely dead by now. And actually, I will say the main way of communications via phones are via cell phones in Venezuela right now. So after that, additional to that, I think it is very difficult for people to make direct international calls. They can only, and they are used to use WhatsApp to make the phone calls and applications on their smartphones. But since the Wi-Fi was totally down in Venezuela, and there was no way to even get the messages through WhatsApp and other apps, so they had no possibility of make international calls because their phones don't have those kind of plans, and especially now because of all the immigration and all the situation with their immigration statuses, even with the new decisions about the bank accounts, they have had their credit cards suspended or eliminated by the banks because of the Trump administration new orders about immigrants that doesn't have a permanent status in the United States. So everything has been very, very, very difficult for Venezuelans in the United States, especially for people, hundreds of thousands that are still in a legal limbo waiting for answers for their immigration applications. So we tried to get a group of volunteers that who were able to make international calls. And actually, we spent almost the whole night making those calls, some successful, some other ones not. And the truth is that right now, 48 hours after, mm-hmm. the catastrophe. There are many, many people that haven't been able to contact their loved ones just yet, or anyone that will give them some information about their relatives just yet.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. We're speaking with Adelis Ferro, the executive director of the South Florida-based Venezuelan American Caucus, about the tragedy and ongoing recovery effort after the earthquakes in Venezuela. A reminder, you can join our conversation, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. The United States Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that the U.S. was deploying aid in the form of search and rescue teams, medical resources, and humanitarian assistance. But obviously, tensions between the U.S. and Venezuela have gone on since the United States seized the former president Nicolas Maduro. How is that tension going to affect aid coming to Venezuela?
That's a very good question. Actually, they are already on the ground. What I haven't seen in the news today, they are already on the ground starting to help. And I hope this time help actually is accepted and effective, because if there is one time that we really need more than never before, is now. But honestly, also, I think the Delcy Rodriguez regime don't have any other options,
right?
And because of the negotiations, but and Venezuelans are welcoming on any help. Obviously, United States is the main partner of the Venezuelan government right now, the main international partner, and probably that's going to be the biggest, hopefully, help that we're going to receive. But we just need so much help.
You mentioned that you were setting up phone banks for international callers. In just 30 seconds here, what can you tell us about the aid efforts that are going on here? How can people help? And what items do Venezuelans need most right now in just the 30 seconds or so we have left?
We are in search and rescue mode for the next few days. What they need on the ground is help with equipment and gloves and boots, I mean, for the rescuers. Mm-hmm. So if you want to help, go to the organizations that are asking for money donations that have direct link with Venezuela, like Caritas Venezuela or Aid for Life, which is a U.S. organizations that are helping with that. Donate money to them, because they all are already buying the resources and the equipments the rescuers needs right now.
Well, thank you. Adelis Ferro is the executive director of the South Florida-based Venezuelan American Caucus. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, on the roundup, the South Florida got a taste of Scotland's rabid football supporter group known as the Tartan Army. Thousands of Scots made their presence known as they prepared for their group stage match against Brazil here in Miami. I caught up with them as they marched from Calle Ocho to Lone Depot Park for a Miami Marlins game. The fans knew very little about baseball, but plenty about partying. The bagpipe signaled the start of the parade through Little Havana, but the party began hours ago. Roughly 8,000 kilted Scots marched more than a mile from the pregame on Calle Ocho to Lone Depot Park. A sea of navy and white and sunburned skin, this is the invading Tartan Army. Fresh off a romp around Boston that saw bars completely drained of beer, the Scotland supporters set their sights on Miami.
Boston was off the chain, but we drunk all the drink, we've still got plenty of beer here.
That's Gervin Easton from Fife. Like many Scots, he's never seen a professional baseball game before.
That's what we do. We just picked a game with nothing to do when the football's not on. Go to the baseball.
Inside the stadium, Marlins fans with guitas, a traditional Dominican percussion instrument, met the chanting Scots. A kind of cultural exchange that only a city like Miami and only an event like the World Cup could produce. Scotland lost 3-0 to Brazil, and they were likely eliminated from the World Cup, but the Tartan Army won the hearts of South Florida and scored a divisive victory in their battle against beer. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Katie Munoz and Denise Royal, with help from Chris DiAvanzo. Denise is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Have a great weekend, South Florida, and thanks for listening.
WLRN.